Clue as we look around the pool. In a matter of Linda Cowley versus Virtua Health System, may we please have appearances?
Justice Mary Kay Wyshock, Department of Care, on behalf of the appellant, Virtua, nurses Gribbin and Curran.
Good morning, Your Honor. Anthony Director of Office of Epstein Bedford Green for the district jury and doctor patient clients.
Good morning, Your Honor. Randy S. Greenberg on behalf of Sick County Maldino on behalf of the attorney Linda and Robert Callan.
Good morning, Justice. This is Patrick Brown from the New World Law Firm on behalf of the New Jersey Association for Justice.
Counsel, just so that we have an understanding, we'll probably break around 12:30. Assuming we're not done at that point, we'll break for about a half hour and then resume the argument afterward. Ms. Wysocki, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. At this point, I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal, 5 minutes, if it is appropriate to the court.
We'll have you back, perhaps for a little less. Go ahead.
Perhaps not at all.
All right.
The issue that we are here today about is the common knowledge doctrine. I'm speaking today on behalf of not only a health system, but two individual nurses, Robin Gribbins and Helene Curran. The care that they provided in October of 2014 to Linda Cowley clearly does not fall within the common knowledge doctrine. It is far too complex. It required medical decision making. Lower court's decision to force the facts of this case into the very narrow confines of the common knowledge doctrine undercuts the validity and applicability of the affidavit of merit statute. It's in essence depriving these two nurses and the health system of the protections afforded to them by that very statute. What we are being asked to determine is whether what the nurses did in regards to Ms. Cowley and the order for her nasogastric tube fell within the common knowledge doctrine. And in candor, what we're really being asked is what plaintiff alleges they failed to do falls within the common knowledge doctrine. What we understand to be the case here is that an order was entered for a nasogastric tube, a very invasive procedure in which the tube is placed through the nose, through the back of the throat, down the esophagus, into the stomach, not under anesthesia, with some topical agents. That is something that the physicians wanted, and what we know from the facts of the case is that it was explained to the patient, it was attempted to be placed by Mr. Gribbin on the 17th, and the patient, in the middle of the procedure, said, no, take it out. She has the right to do that. He followed her orders. That information was communicated to the incoming nurse in the morning, who again explained to the patient why it was important that this tube be placed. The patient again said no. The nurse contacted a physician. The tube was placed later that morning. We know that the following evening, the tube was removed by Ms. Cowley. The nurses again, according to the records, talked to her about replacement. She said no. Following morning, again, talked to her about replacement. She said no. The doctor was contacted. Ultimately, it was placed later in the morning based on the doctor's notes, which talk about it being present, and she went on for surgery. Those facts cannot, under any circumstances, constitute common knowledge. This court has held, in very narrow circumstances, that common knowledge can be applied to the affidavit of merit statute. Those facts that permit that common knowledge doctrine are so obvious on their face that yes, an average person, normal intelligence and everyday experiences can determine that it was common knowledge that something was done or not done. The court is familiar with those cases, but for purposes of comparison, we need to talk about those facts. Those facts are, in Plank, misreading the numbers on a piece of paper on a medical report and reading the identification test numbers as the test results. I don't need to be a physician. The jury does not need to be a physician to know that that constitutes common knowledge, that you should know the difference between reading the numbers that are the test identification and reading the results. Hubbard, supposed to remove an incisor on the left, removes a molar on the right. We do not need to have gone to dental school to know that that is negligence. Not only are those cases so obvious on their face of what was done wrong, we can tell based on the facts what should have been done. You should have taken out the correct tooth. You should have read the right results. The appellate division in this case has simply found that the facts fall within the common knowledge doctrine because common sense tells you the nurses should have done something. That is not enough to establish a standard of care or to get over the threshold of the affidavit of merit statute, because even the appellate division was unable to say, under the standard of care in this clinical circumstance, what were those nurses required to do. If on the face of the allegation you cannot conclude clearly and unambiguously what was required, it cannot be common knowledge.
So is it appropriate at this stage to look beyond the allegations in the pleadings? You've relied on facts that do, of course.
I believe that it is. And the sole reason that that is the case is because the affidavit merit statute itself requires that to occur. If this is deemed to be a typical malpractice case, the expert is going to review the medical record. There's no other record yet other than what's in the medical record.
Were these medical records before the trial judge?
Portions of them were, Your Honor, yes.
Well, the facts that you've related to us, are they all in the trial record?
They are not. They were components of them were placed into the appellate record. They were not in the trial record. The facts were in the trial record. The documents themselves were not in the trial record. So I should clarify that.
And the question, I'm sorry.
No, so did you expand the record before the appellate division?
We did not. Yes, we did not expand the record before the appellate division. The plaintiff, in his appeal brief, expanded it to include the progress note of the physician who placed the NG tube on the day of surgery.
And the questions and answers really raise an issue with respect to how courts should decide affidavit of merit issues that are not just purely cut and dried, simple, either there is an affidavit of merit or there isn't. The need for an affidavit of merit really implicates facts. I mean, should these cases, should the courts be entertaining early summary judgment motions that rely on facts outside of the pleadings in order to decide this issue? Because you are making a motion but relying on facts outside of the pleadings.
I don't believe, Justice, that the decision as to whether an affidavit of merit is required requires us to go to the level of a summary judgment motion.
Why? Because the dividing line between summary judgment and the motion to dismiss is that a motion to dismiss, you can find the inquiry to the facts set forth in the pleading, but in a summary judgment motion, you can consider matters outside of the record of the pleading.
That is correct, but the decision that is being entertained at the point of an affidavit of merit motion is the case common knowledge or is an affidavit required?
Right. But in that, all I'm saying is I'm not being in any way critical to the way either counsel handled this case, but are we really, isn't it the right way to have a narrow summary judgment and at least have the court have available to it some of the medical records that may be pertinent?
I don't think that the affidavit of merit motion on its face precludes either party from submitting the medical record or the relevant components of the medical record for the affidavit of merit motion on its face. And in this case, we were the moving party on a dismissal motion.
If the court relies on facts outside the record, it becomes a summary judgment motion. So essentially, the rule is the same, and it sort of morphs into that once facts are put.
And essentially, in practice, affidavit of merit motions are typically heard on a 28-day cycle because almost always they have to go beyond what is actually contained within the face of the pleadings
complaint.
Unless someone has chosen to plead with specificity the facts of the case.
Your argument is that no physician who is issuing an affidavit of merit can do so without resort to the medical records.
That is my understanding.
And you're saying it wouldn't make sense that in a common knowledge case that the plaintiff can merely allege matters without reference to any medical records.
That is correct, Your Honor, because if we are going to rely simply on what the plaintiff alleges, almost any medical negligence case can be described in such simple terms that on its face it appears to be common knowledge. By way of example, if my patient is undergoing a hysterectomy and I cut the ureter, I'm not supposed to cut the ureter. Therefore, that is common knowledge. You must have done something wrong.
We know
that is not a common knowledge case.
The other thing, the allegations in a complaint possibly may have no relationship to what's in the medical records. So if there isn't resort to the medical records at, let's say, a Ferreira conference, which there wasn't, that's another issue over here, then it would seem that the very purpose of the affidavit of merit statute is probably undermined. No?
Well, I don't know that the medical records really have to be handled at the Ferreira conference, but at a minimum, the court has to look beyond the plain face of the complaint
How does it do that without someone submitting the medical records?
And there's nothing that prevents someone from submitting those records as part of an affidavit of merit motion. I will tell you quite candidly, the majority of affidavit of merit motions don't have to do with common knowledge. It's usually the credentials. So that is something that is often submitted as the component of the affidavit of merit and is outside the scope of the actual complaint or the affidavit of merit that has been served. But there is nothing that prevents that. And I will briefly touch, because I'm sure we will get back to it, the issue of the Ferreira conference, because no, there was not one held here. I don't think that is relevant to this case, because plaintiff's position from the beginning up to today is that it is a common knowledge case.
Except if had there been a Ferreira conference, and had the judge looked at the case and said, not a common knowledge case, file an AOM or you're out, that could have changed the complexion of this case, no?
That is not typically something that gets raised in a Ferreira conference.
Well, it should have been, because in Ferreira, the defense is supposed to make its objections known. And if there was no affidavit of merit filed, the defendant should have gotten up, had it been held, and said, I don't have an affidavit, and the common knowledge doctrine doesn't apply here. And then the judge would have had to make a decision.
I don't.
In your answer, didn't you demand an affidavit of merit?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And with respect, I do not believe that the jurisprudence requires me to affirmatively say, and this is not one of my objections is this is not a common knowledge case. My obligation under our jurisprudence at this point is to attend the Ferreira conference and advise the court whether I have received an affidavit of merit. And if I have received that affidavit of merit, if I have any objection to the credentials of the affiant. And that is something I must do in writing as well as...
Our case law says if you have any objection, not just to the credentials, we have case law that says if there's a defect in the affidavit itself, the objections are supposed to be made known at the time of the Ferreira conference. Correct?
That is correct. And typically, but if there is no affidavit of merit, there is no defect in that affidavit of merit at that point in time. And I do not believe that a Ferreira conference is the place for the courts to decide that it is or is not a common knowledge case,
A judge could not say that at a Ferreira conference because he or she has no evidence before them either way. It's ruling without any basis in fact, and all the judge would say is, you take your chances, and when they file a motion, I'll deal with it at that point, but I can't determine today whether anything before me, whether this is common knowledge or not. I don't think there's any judge that would ever be capable of doing that unless he or she is a mind reader.
Even if the issues
are raised, that's not what the Ferreira conferences are for.
Even if there is an issue raised as to whether a specific type of affidavit is required, the trial judges routinely report that they are not in a position to make that decision. Counsel, you've heard the objections. You understand the case law. Get an affidavit of merit or expect that the motion will be filed.
Isn't the
back and forth typically in an affidavit.
Isn't the point that the conference might well have fleshed out the existence of the issue and moved things along in that regard?
It might have. I mean, clearly if the plaintiff had said, I think this is a common knowledge case, at that juncture, the court may have said, may be, may not be. you might want to think about that.
Well, walk us through the timeframe.
But I'm not sure that it's the trial court's job to alert the plaintiff if the plaintiff is aware that he has a malpractice case that is being asserted, and he knows what his obligations are. He has assessed his case as to whether or not the court saying maybe, may not be, is going to change that thinking.
Counsel,
cause him to think yes.
Counsel, walk us through the time frame. You made the demand for the affidavit of merit. The statute presumptively requires affidavits of merit in professional malpractice actions.
Correct.
The response to your motion, and I'm not sure, I've forgotten the timing of it in relation to if there had been a Ferrara conference, where we are in time, was to substantively respond by saying that they believed this was a common knowledge case.
That is correct.
So you did have the response, and the question then is who's bearing the burden of proving that this is a common knowledge exception case to the overriding requirement of the statute?
It would be our position that that is the plaintiff's burden, because the plaintiff is the one who bears the responsibility of serving the affidavit of merit and is looking for the exception to relieve him of that burden of providing an affidavit of merit.
So if that's, if the court agrees with you, are you suggesting that, that there's some special obligation on plaintiff's counsel to insist on the Ferrara conference to flesh out this theory of common knowledge applying in this setting?
I think that, taken to its logical conclusion, it is the plaintiff's burden to produce the affidavit. And if, in fact, there is some question in plaintiff's mind and they choose, they don't want to go to that step and get an affidavit, then they need to take some step.
But at this point, so you didn't answer my question about the timing. The motion was filed by you at what point in the litigation in terms of?
Very early. I do
was
not
it
know
within
the
120
dates.
Days?
It was filed some shortly after the 120-day mark.
Okay.
Because typically the courts have permitted that extra 60 days to right. file earlier, basically deprives the plaintiffs of that extra 60 days. So it was filed very close in time to that 120-day mark.
Step back from the particulars of the facts here for a second and give us, based on your experience, what you think best practices would be. You have a complaint in a few lines that articulates, you know, just a few facts. What should occur, looking beyond the pleadings at this point? What type of information can be looked at, should be looked at in these cases?
For purposes of determining whether an affidavit of merit is required.
Early on, often pre-discovery.
The only thing that needs to be reviewed are the relevant medical records. So if it's a hospital case or a surgery case, it's those hospital records.
So you really are in summary judgment world. I'm not suggesting necessarily that has to wait until the close of discovery, but this is, Chief, were you done?
Please go ahead.
Yeah. This is a summary judgment motion.
In essence, it's not called that, but
it does function
in that fashion because it is, unlike a summary judgment, it's a dismissal with prejudice, and it is looking generally at facts outside the pleadings themselves.
Because, in fact, if you're looking at a 462 motion would say the pleadings, take the plaintiff's pleadings as true, and there's no pleading here, there's nothing in the pleading that says, I don't need an affidavit of merit, because this is a common knowledge case. That's not pled.
Right, that is not pled.
So the pleading doesn't deal with this issue at all. So even if you give the plaintiffs all due inferences of fact, they haven't pled the facts that are necessary to the disposition of the motion. What I'm suggesting is they have not. Without being critical to either party in this case, that the 462 motion may not be a good fit.
Because we are a notice pleading state, that is correct, because we are not required to include a great deal of facts, and most complaints do not have a great deal
right.
of facts.
I mean, a plaintiff could plead a case that had all the details or some details and then said, this is a common knowledge case, therefore I'm not going to file a motion, I don't have to file a motion, but that would be unusual and probably not a great strategy.
Correct. And there's nothing that precludes the plaintiff early in the litigation before the 120 days has run, aside from a Ferrara conference, from making an application to the court for a ruling on whether or not it is a common knowledge case. We have had experiences where people have made that application to determine the legitimacy or sufficiency of the credentials of their experts so that they are not, you know, running out of time at mm-hmm. the 11th hour.
The court, I'm sorry.
Who should have the obligation of presenting the relevant medical records at this early stage in the case?
I'm sorry, to whom? To the court?
In the context of resolving this.
I believe the plaintiff. The plaintiff has the burden of establishing that, of either obtaining an affidavit of merits or establishing that one is not required. Because it is their burden to determine that the case has meet that threshold requirement of merit. So to the extent the records have to be established, then they need to come from the
and
plaintiff.
And when should it be done? Doesn't it make sense that this would be done at the Ferreira conference so that if the common knowledge doctrine does not apply, the plaintiff will have an opportunity of getting an affidavit of merit?
Respectfully, although it might seem to make sense on its face, the Ferreira conference is not designed, at least in its current format, to accommodate a judicial decision of that nature.
Because the judge is not in a position to make that decision.
He is not.
He doesn't know anything. And if a plaintiff sits in front of him and says, it's common knowledge,
The only thing the judge has at that juncture is he or she knows that they have a malpractice case, because we wouldn't have a Ferreira conference if there wasn't some sort of professional liability. Mm-hmm. He has the complaint, and he knows that either an affidavit has not been served or the affidavit that has been served has some deficiency in it by way of usually specialty.
Says,
that is the sum total.
And once the plaintiff says, I'm relying on common knowledge, sitting there saying, all right, defend it. If you want to make your motion, make your motion.
And that is
flesh it out in the motion.
Typically what occurs. Again, more generally in this context of it's an insufficient affidavit. It either, you know, the credentials don't cover all of the defendants. But yes, at that juncture, the burden then goes on the plaintiff to either correct the deficiency that has been potentially addressed with no indication from the trial judge that he or she agrees or disagrees with the objection that has been leveled, or to roll the dice.
Do you agree that you have the obligation at the Ferreira conference to at least object to the plaintiff's reliance on the common knowledge doctrine?
If in fact a plaintiff's attorney represented to the court that they had no intentions of securing an affidavit of merit because they were relying on the common knowledge doctrine, I do believe I would have an affirmative duty at that point to say, I disagree, I do not believe this is a common knowledge case, and if no affidavit is served, we will be moving for a dismissal.
Can common knowledge ever apply when there's an act of judgment that's involved in the professional's actions?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
And is that basically the position of the hospital and the nurses here?
In this case, this was clearly an act of judgment. There are a litany of things that have to happen in this factual circumstance with a patient who has an order for something that is known to be unpleasant, and the efforts that are undertaken in how to get that done.
Yeah, you started before to talk about Plank and Hubbard. I mean, mm-hmm. the common knowledge cases that we've seen before are really rather cut and dried, left versus right, you know, looking at the wrong number on a form. That is not anything to deal with the exercise of professional judgment. I have never seen common knowledge being asserted in the way it's being asserted in this setting. Is it being expanded in its use before the trial courts in your experience?
Not in my experience. This was an unusual event for us as well. I think that the common knowledge doctrine is recognized as something at the trial level that is as obvious as anything can be. And it's obvious not only in the negligence.
It doesn't appear in the statute. I mean, obviously it's judicially created as something that the court felt was obvious in those cases before. But if we're getting into the kind of cases that we're discussing now, I'm wondering, is this an expansion, an overexpansion of the use of this terminology?
It is our position that it is clearly an unreasonable expansion of what should be a very narrowly construed doctrine. And I can think of a multitude of other things that, if pled simply, could invoke the common knowledge doctrine when in fact they will not. And the other thing that I think needs to be put before this court at this point is the question of, you know, if no one is able to say what the nurses were supposed to do, then it can't be common knowledge.
That's the essence of what you usually see in an affidavit of merit, at least that
correct.
Initial call that it was within the range of professional.
Correct. And understand, as I'm sure the court is well aware, the affidavit of merit is a very general statement. It does not at that level specify what the negligence was, but it is premised on a review of the medical records at issue so that the person who has looked at it understands the facts of the case and is saying, based on what I, as a registered nurse or as a licensed physician, have reviewed, the care fell below accepted standards.
So here's plaintiff's theory, which they've argued. They at least one theory is that when they observe a patient there's a physician's order to have the nasogastric tube in, and they look at the patient and it's not in, that their options do not include going back to the nurse's station and doing nothing. That's the theory.
That is the theory, and our position is that theory is not supported by the facts of this case, and it has been put forth as a oversimplified recitation of the facts, because the actual complaint says it wasn't, the nasogastric tube was never placed, and we know that it was in fact placed and removed and then replaced.
Okay, but obviously that plays out in the course of the case. To let's say just very simply, you know, you file a motion to dismiss. We assume the truth of the plaintiff's allegations in a motion to dismiss. Can you, at least at this early stage, can a plaintiff say that it is common knowledge, if in fact, and facts will play out as they will, but if in fact the nurses, and I'm not saying this happened or didn't happen, it's what the plaintiffs say happened, observe this, know there's an order that says the tube's in, see the patient, tube's out, do nothing, don't make a call to the doctor even. They say that's common knowledge, that anybody on a jury would know that you do something, even if it's to make a call and have the doctor say, well, what do you think, and everybody decides, let's just leave her the way she is. That's medical judgment at that point, but the raising it is so obvious that you don't need an affidavit.
And although I understand and I can see that argument, at that juncture I raise the issue of patient autonomy, because there are circumstances where if the patient has elected not to do that, then it is not common knowledge that a nurse is required to do something more. That brings in an entirely different judgment and decision tree on behalf of the nurse. So if we know that the patient has said, no, I don't want this, take this out, I don't want this, and the nurse comes in and sees it out, she can,
and
arguably. That is not common knowledge whether she can go back to her desk or whether she needs to make a phone call.
And you say informed consent. You know, issues go to professional standards, and that requires an affidavit. But just the idea that nobody's the plaintiff's theory that nobody did anything. Okay, let's not don't assume whether the patient pulled it out, it might have fallen out, but that there was complete inaction. That's the theory. So they're saying, and it perhaps is a risky strategy, but they're saying, if it happened the way we say it happened, it's common knowledge because nobody did anything. And this tube was out. Doesn't matter why. It's supposed to be in. It's out. Common knowledge that you do something.
So if, in fact, the facts are that there is an order for an NG tube, the nurse knows there's an order for an NG tube, she sees there's no NG tube, and she doesn't inquire any further and just walks back and has a cup of coffee, is that common knowledge? If those are the limited facts, it could be.
Okay, so why doesn't the plaintiff have a shot at getting by without an affidavit of merit based on their factual assertion, even though it later may prove that they absolutely need an expert?
Well, the interesting one, I do not believe they can, because the facts are not, and this is not the facts are not as they have presented them based on the actual documents, not based on a version we are putting forward,
so the
deposition.
Are the facts in dispute? for instance, has a plaintiff filed an affidavit or some verified statement contesting the assertions that you've made before this court and what you say are in the medical record?
I have not seen anything to that extent, but I believe at the trial level, it was conceded, and I believe it may have even been conceded at the appellate argument, that in fact the tube was placed, it was pulled out by the patient.
It is.
The patient refused to have it replaced. So those facts are conceded.
You're telling us that it's an uncontested fact that the plaintiff pulled out the tube and refused to have it reinserted?
I believe that the term that the plaintiff uses is the word dislodged.
I thought that the plaintiff conceded that either it was removed by the patient or it came out of place.
Correct. And she refused to have it replaced.
And you're saying that's an uncontested fact?
That is my understanding, that those facts at least are uncontested.
And you say that's significant because the allegation that this tube was never, the order was not followed, is conceded to be untrue.
Correct.
Do we know what fluids or substances were?
I missed the beginning of your
question. Do we know what fluids or substances were going through the nasal gastrotube into the plaintiff's stomach? Is that part of the record?
Is that part of the record?
Yeah.
Yes. It's not part of the trial record. It's part of the medical record, and they were actually going in reverse. So the purpose of the tube in this particular patient was to decompress the stomach. She had been diagnosed with a small bowel obstruction, presumably, and they did not know the cause of that small bowel obstruction, whether it was a twist, whether it was some adhesions, or whether it was a mass. And the concept of the nasogastric tube was to try and bring some of the stuff out of the stomach, take the pressure off of the small bowel, and see if that obstruction would resolve itself. So it was stomach contents coming out of the stomach through the tube to a suction container on the wall. And the one medical record that is below as part of the record does document that, in fact, that morning it is in place and it is pulling, because it actually quantifies the volume that has been removed since it's been replaced.
Counsel, we're a little beyond 30 minutes at this point. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Not at this juncture, Your Honor.
Good. Mr. Poe, I'm sure we can bring it home in the next few minutes. You dropped a few sheets.
No, don't worry. You ought to make it shorter.
Your Honors, Eric Poe on behalf of New Jersey Pure Amicus. As you may recognize, in 2 short years, this is the third time that we've appeared and been granted the honor and privilege to be before you, arguing as to why the importance of the affidavit of merit statute is vital for the protection of medical malpractice rates as well as doctors in the state of New Jersey. Contrary to my opposition counsel, who tried to argue why we don't have other insurance carriers before us, it is our unique business model where we don't use agents and brokers, and that we actually are the only carrier in the state that employs its own internal law firm to oversee our claims, that we understand the magnitude and why no other carrier has been before us in these three other opportunities before you. And we understand, as I said 2 weeks ago, the toll emotionally, financially, and physically that doctors have to embark upon when there's an allegation of medical malpractice. That toll takes 5 years.
Can I ask you to focus on what the appropriate procedure should be in a case like this involving common knowledge?
Your Honors, in listening to your questions to my co-counsel or counsel here before me, it does glean to me from the record that it seems that there's a lot of confusion in the courts because they don't go back to the original holding by this court in 1961 in Sanzari, where it was the first time that the common knowledge doctrine was ever introduced in the context of a medical malpractice case. And in that actual holding by this court in 1961, what seems to be embedded in the decision is that you first must find proximate cause. And there is no dispute on the proximate cause. If you look at all the cases that are before you in both adversarial as well as our counsel's briefs, you will see that in every one of these cases, what distinguishes this case from those cases is that proximate cause is not even being argued. There's two elements in a case for medical malpractice: deviation of the standard of care and proximate cause of that deviation being to the injury of that patient.
But that preceded the affidavit of merit.
Yes, you're right.
So your argument is a little bit more difficult, because by saying ultimately, at trial, yes, there should be proximate cause identified by the plaintiff. But be fair to the plaintiff here. The plaintiff has a very short timeline to produce an affidavit of merit, and it doesn't have time to even start discovery during that time, let alone prove anything to anybody.
Well, I think that's where a lot of times the courts don't appreciate the actual process here. The reality is that we have 2-year statute of limitations for any reasonable belief that there was an injury that occurred to a patient in this state. The plaintiffs have their own ability to get their own medical records to review. They have HIPAA. All they need to do is actually file, and this is what traditionally happens. They file to every single doctor that's ever been cared for by their client for all the medical records. They review those cases potentially up for 2 years. And if they don't have 2 years, Your Honor, they also can John Doe every single caregiver in the medical record.
Understood, but we're not talking about statute of limitations. We're talking about a statutory, very limited timeline to get that after the complaint is filed, to get that affidavit of merit. And if you're not just talking about knowing your case. I agree with you that people have an obligation before they file a complaint to review the medical records and know their case and make allegations that are fairly based on the medical records. But the issue is trying to get out from under the affidavit of merit, and you're saying that we should require proximate cause to be proven, and proximate cause can't be proven to anybody in the first 90 days of a litigation.
Your Honor, I would respectfully like to recast what I'm saying here. What I'm saying here is that the common knowledge exception was evolved from 1961 in the Sinzera case.
Right.
And in that case, the common knowledge exception was one in which they narrowly carved out to say, in the context of whether experts are needed for a trier of fact to determine whether or not a doctor is liable in a case of medical malpractice,
right. We'll
create this common knowledge exception in that context. Now, in this court in 2001, in the infancy of the actual affidavit of merit statute, that's when, for the first time, you had to balance the difference between this common knowledge exception and the affidavit of merit.
Let me go back a little bit to something just about. The affidavit of merit doesn't come into play until you file the complaint, but you actually have 2 years from the incident, and perhaps longer with the discovery rule, to investigate, obtain all the medical records. So when you file the complaint, my understanding, having defended cases here and there, is that plaintiffs take all that time. They cover no medical malpractice lawsuits generally filed unless there's an expert that will testify, and all that stuff is done. So the affidavit of merit is a short period, but it doesn't. It's not triggered until the complaint is actually filed, and you have ample time before the complaint to do all your discovery.
Correct, Your Honor.
Tell me if I'm mistaken about this. The affidavit of merit statute does not require that the expert opine about proximate cause, merely about the duty of care. Am I mistaken about that?
Well, you're not mistaken in the reading of the actual statute, but I would argue our position is that the actual statute embeds the proximate cause when it refers to the allegations contained in the complaint. And without a cause of action, the cause of action in the complaint itself has to have proximate cause or it doesn't meet the elements.
I know the complaint does, and they have to prove that, but I'm looking at the affidavit of merit statute, which says provide each defendant with an affidavit of an appropriate licensed person that there exists a reasonable probability that the care, skill, or knowledge exercised or exhibited in the treatment, practice, or work that is the subject of the complaint fell outside acceptable professional or occupational standards of treatment practices. Now, I've read that's what the affidavit of merit. I am not saying that the plaintiff doesn't have to prove proximate cause, doesn't have to allege proximate cause in the complaint, but the affidavit of merit does not seem to require a proximate cause analysis. Am I mistaken about that?
Our position would be, Your Honor, that subject to the allegations in the complaint, which is written in the statute which Your Honor just read, is implicit that proximate cause would have to be reviewed by that medical.
Is there any case that interprets that statute as requiring a statement of proximate cause in the affidavit of merit?
No, Your Honor, there is not.
Why aren't you simply arguing that the facts of this case talk about medical judgment, that they implicate medical judgment?
Well, Your Honor, yes, I would say that.
And therefore, it can't be a common knowledge case, because as soon as you are in the world of medical judgment, you've crossed the line between common knowledge and the need for an affidavit of merit.
Yes, Your Honor, and actually, that goes to our second point of addressing the NJAJ's position on the Ferreira Conference being the appropriate remedy in this scenario. We disagree wholeheartedly that the Ferreira Conference is the right form to address this. Number one, in the Ferreira Conference, as spoken to earlier, the judge doesn't have any idea of what the allegations are contained in the medical record. It's really to determine whether or not there's a defect in the affidavit. Also, more importantly, now this is a very slippery slope. It's not just a slippery slope. I would analogize it to going down, you know, Mount Kilimanjaro in terms of the type of slope that we're talking about here. Now we're asking a judge in a Ferreira conference to decide what is common knowledge versus what is a medical expert required to actually provide. And that's where we feel like, you know, you're going to be putting all of us in terms of doctors and insurance carriers in a precarious position if Ferreira conference.
So your argument is there should be a very fast motion up front by the defendant to say this is not common knowledge?
By the plaintiff.
You think the plaintiff should be required to move for an exception to the affidavit of merit?
I mean, if you really want our position is that Hubbard and Palik or Palank should be revisited, because we don't believe that the equitable remedy of the common knowledge exception should really apply in an affidavit of merit statute, considering its unambiguous language created by the legislature.
That's not something the defendant is claiming.
I understand, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Assume those cases are good law. You're here as a friend of the court. Yes. The purpose of the statute, of course, is to weed out frivolous cases and allow meritorious ones to go forward. What should the practice be? Do you have a recommendation?
Assuming that case law is correct, we would assume that they would have to file a DJ action in order to declare and have the actual judge review the medical records to decide whether or not that common knowledge exception applies, but also for this court to create a bright line rule.
It's a declaratory judgment action separate of the malpractice complaint? That's what you're suggesting is?
Immediately upon, or file a motion, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So a separate lawsuit to decide what common knowledge is?
Well, either a separate lawsuit or file a motion in the presiding case right then and there.
You could file a motion.
You've been arguing it's too expensive for your counsel, and you're suggesting now that defending a second lawsuit on the same issue is cost efficient and favorable to you?
Your Honors, in the rare cases which this court
reviews affidavit merit. Not the rare cases. You said any time common knowledge, you should file a declaratory judgment action. How does that play into the argument you made earlier that this is cost prohibitive to defend doctors for litigation, that somehow defending a second lawsuit is less expensive?
Well, a DJ action is not necessarily, in our opinion, if we're speaking out of both sides of our mouth in terms of why this is such a common knowledge exception that a layperson of average intelligence can understand it, but at the same point in time, we can't find an affidavit from one of the 2.7 million nurses in the United States of America. It seems to be that I don't think the DJ action would take a lot to actually defend, because it's either common knowledge or not. I don't think it would actually be that long for either a motion judge or in a DJ action for them to decide that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, how long do you hope to present?
Not very long.
Let's try to quantify that. Less than 5 minutes?
Depending if I'm not gonna, based on what I heard, I'm
then please come forward.
Finer points rather than
wonderful. Please come forward.
Thank you, Your Honors. I represent the New Jersey Doctor Patient Alliance. It's a nonprofit organization made up of approximately 300 independent physicians and also patients as well. I've appeared before the court before, and I want to address a theme that has arisen, which is, well, what's an appropriate way to proceed on a going forward basis? From my constituency's perspective, the physicians, we have an affidavit of merit statute that's designed to avoid extensive, protracted, expensive litigation. As a threshold matter, the plaintiff has an obligation to provide an affidavit of merit to proceed. We have a very narrow carve-out, and we're here spending a lot of time litigating how do we deal with this carve-out to determine whether or not it should apply. It would seem to my constituents and to me as a friend of the court, if a cause before the Superior Court of New Jersey falls within the common knowledge exception, it should be very, very simple to obtain an affidavit of merit. Now, whether a plaintiff ultimately elects to proceed with the retention of an expert to put his or her case on through expert testimony, that's a decision that he or she can make later.
So if there is a genuine common knowledge case, you don't need the affidavit of merit, and you're suggesting to us that the way to resolve that matter is to get the affidavit of merit. That doesn't sound right.
The statute makes affidavits of merit mandatory.
Do you need an affidavit of merit if the ankle that was cut off was the right ankle and not the left ankle as it was supposed to be?
Ouch.
So I think that there's a question embedded in that. The question embedded in that is, do you require an expert expert testimony to establish that there was a breach of the duty of care to prevail in your case? I would say absolutely not. I don't think that that case would ever go that far if that's what's happening.
But you suggested you need an affidavit of merit for some expert to say this is common knowledge, you don't need an affidavit of merit?
Is that
what the affidavit of merit will say, you envision?
I believe that if a...
And there's no need for an affidavit of merit, and this is my affidavit of merit?
Put differently...
Let's put it that way. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying that if there is a breach of duty that is so clear that a plaintiff should have absolutely no problem obtaining an affidavit
but
of merit.
But it's not required for common knowledge, so that's why I'm asking. What would that affidavit of merit say? I've reviewed the records, and I find that you don't need an affidavit of merit because it's common knowledge. Is that what the affidavit of merit will say?
No, the affidavit of merit would say, I reviewed the records because plaintiffs are the masters of their case. They're not dangling.
Well, but that's not, what will it say?
It would say, I have reviewed the records, and I determined that there was a breach of the professional duty of care owed by this physician when he removed the left foot instead of the right foot.
What's left of the exception then? This is an exception to the affidavit of merit requirement. What's left of that?
Well, the question that I was responding to and the theme that I was responding to is, well, what should we do? Mm-hmm. And respectfully, again, from a physician's perspective, what we should do is apply the affidavit of merit statute. And a way to avoid this entirely, frankly, is this case, these facts, do in fact present an instance where the exception is going to swallow the rule. You can plead yourself out of an affidavit of merit case based on the pleadings in this case.
Help us with this situation, because there really is the issue as to whether there should be a common knowledge exception. It's not before the court.
Correct.
It hasn't been raised by the defendant, hasn't been raised by either party. So assume that the common knowledge exception is going to survive to live to see another day. And assume that we are looking for a way that is consistent with our court rules and that is fair to all parties to have an adjudication of whether or not the affidavit of merit is necessary in an expeditious manner. And when I say consistent with our court rules, as to what the court is restricted as to what the court can consider on a motion to dismiss. What is a process that would be expeditious, that would be fair, that would get the issue properly before a trial court as to whether the common knowledge exception applies?
And I think that the answer to Your Honor's question assumes that there should be such a process. And when the way that this exception is laid out fairly and appropriately is, when one reads the pleadings, you know, to His Honor's point, when one reads the pleadings, the court should walk away knowing, absolutely, yes, this is a common knowledge case. If the court cannot make that determination based on the pleadings, it's not a common knowledge case. An affidavit of merit's necessary. And if a plaintiff, as a master of her case, decides, and her counsel decides together, as they should, that we are not going to proceed with an affidavit.
But that would really change our law. That would really change our law, because there are many statutory obligations and burdens that are put on parties in litigation, but we don't expect plaintiffs to say, here's all the different things that are going to happen in the case in their ultimate pleading. We have notice pleading in New Jersey, as was pointed out. We do not require people to say, and by the way, I'm going to get past summary judgment, and I'm also going to get past the requirement I'm also going to have an expert, or I don't need an expert. That's not required in a pleading. What is wrong with an early motion that crystallizes the issue for the trial judge with the documents that the trial judge needs to make the determination?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that concept. It's the equivalent, but isn't it equivalent to the motion to dismiss that was filed in this case, where the plaintiff?
Well, the problem
with
the motion
forward.
To dismiss is that the motion to dismiss, by under our court rules, is limited to the pleadings.
And so you're saying
we should impose a requirement to put this all in a complaint?
If the court is considering fashioning, well. So let me address it a bit holistically. If the court's considering fashioning some new procedure specific to determining whether this narrow exception applies, then there should be a requirement that the plaintiffs come forward with all of the medical evidence that they have to establish at the court that the common knowledge doctrine applies, and that should be done very early
in the case,
But in practice, when a motion to dismiss is filed, invariably the parties do supplement the record, and it's converted, as one of the justices pointed out, to a motion for summary judgment,
okay.
Which is why maybe we don't need to reinvent the wheel. What we need to do, again, from the physicians practicing in New Jersey, what we should be doing is really construing the exception as narrowly as it was intended to be.
Your argument is it's supposed to be a narrow exception and do it early so that people are the people that you are representing or your insurer is insuring are not required to stay for 2 years while the case is playing out.
Your Honor said it much more efficiently than I did.
You're saying do exactly what happened here.
From our perspective, there's nothing wrong with the process that occurred here.
Okay.
This is simply a case where, given the professional judgment at issue, and given the pleading,
different issue.
The exception doesn't apply. And if we were to apply it in this case, we're swallowing the rule, which I think would lead to discussions about how should we proceed in the future.
But we've talked about Hubbard, the common knowledge doctrine. And it says it applies in circumstances where jurors' common knowledge as laypersons is sufficient to enable them, using ordinary understanding and experience, to determine a defendant's negligence without the benefit of the specialized knowledge of experts. That's not difficult.
It shouldn't be.
I mean, it's not a difficult standard.
No, and that standard applied here results in, appropriately, the dismissal of the case as a trial court originally ruled. The standard is clear. The question, and I think the point of all of this is, if you have some level of professional judgment that's required, and I dare say that the common juror doesn't know what an NG tube is. The common juror doesn't know what's involved in determining whether to reinsert one. What's the output of the fluid? Is there an esophageal stricture? Is there a chance of a perforation in the bowel? It's a dangerous procedure. It can cause the stomach to turn over on itself. And then on top of that,
you know, we are going to eat lunch after this.
He is.
I am, as a matter of fact. But my point is that all of these are factors that go into whether to reinsert a tube. It's not simply, oh, I didn't flip a switch on a machine, or, oh, I hate to put it to use these this kind of coarse analogy, but it's not, I amputated the wrong limb. Those are terrible, and they're obvious. This isn't obvious, and that's why applying Hubbard, applying the narrow exception as you're supposed to here, it would result in a dismissal of the case, and that's why the appellate court erred. Again, the exception that's urged by counsel and the exception that as applied by the appellate division swallows the rule.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
In about a half hour.
Enjoy your lunch.
Sorry.